Kinda.
I'm gonna invite our guest on real quick. Let me,
Hello, by the way.
Oh, hey, Mike. How's it
going?
Hello.
I just got on.
How do I add someone to the call?
Participants. And, well,
I add Skype contacts. Here we go. I think this. All right. Theus Brown, are you with us 100%?
Minnowee, not Bisbee.
All right. All right. That's great. Now we can hear you. This is good. I'm excited.
I appreciate your face. I'm honored to be on, guys. I appreciate the invite. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you, Theus.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. It's been a long day. I look like hell. It's been a 20-hour day. I had your other podcast and work, and I'm out of it. So I'm sorry, guys.
Good.
Oh, man. This is the podcast marathon. This is good.
Yeah.
We're podcasters. Like we get it.
I feel like Dick Vitale or somebody, right?
Right on.
Theus, I'm Mike. How do you know Matt here?
Matt was a neighbor of mine in the great Illinois area, and we attended College of the Page together and a few religious study groups. So he's a good man. It comes from a great family and just a good friend.
Sort of the tradition with these speech guys here is having some guest introduce the episode. So since you're the new face tonight, we'll just have you be the default call-in guest here. Feel adventurous and bold enough to sort of set the tone for the episode. If you could just say who's on, what speech we're going to be talking about tonight, and put that all in a very snappy delivery, we would be indebted to you.
And tonight's episode, folks, is going to be over the a great movie in sports and teaches a lot about life lessons and how it equates to society in Moneyball. Yep. We'll go over how it affects society, how money and different elements of from that speech it still is true today and affects what goes on in society and sports.
But, Theus, we're not a movie podcast. We're a speech podcast.
I had to tie in. All great speeches come from movies, and all movies come from speeches.
What do we have for a title of the speech, Matt?
Let me think here. 41 million, you built a playoff team.
Nope. What? Well, you know what, guys?
Yeah, 41 right. million. All right, we'll shorten it. 41
we got,
million.
We've got approximately 70 minutes here to figure out a great title. Hey, thanks for listening. Let's go ahead and cue the music.
Michael Schaefer, Ross Johnson, Matt Schultz, and Landon Fry are all here this evening.
Free.
Perspective. I've been back and
I'm just gonna say it. I've been thinking it for 10 minutes. I don't want to podcast here.
Oh yeah. Ashes. Now
I've seen the road. Pregnancy is a beautiful thing. Pregnancy is a gift. Shit. Oh,
there are stories to tell. What kind of paint sticks to asteroids?
If you don't time your walls. Afraid some days, but the road will
lead us to a better place. We are called to emerge from that default setting of self-involvement.
Okay, we got Theus on the cast tonight, in addition to the usuals, Matt, Landon, Ross. Matt was the speech picker. Matt, what do we got for our speeches from Oscar-nominated films?
So, the Oscar-nominated film is the movie Moneyball. the speech is toward the end of the movie, where the general manager of the Boston Red Sox is offering a job to Billy Beane, the main character in the movie. And kind of a rogue, maverick general manager who bucked a lot of trends by instituting a lot of computer analysis and things like that to the game of baseball. So without further ado, we'll hear the speech and then we'll get into why it's relevant.
Let's take a listen.
Steve told me he's offering you a new contract.
Yes.
So why did you return my call?
Because it's the Red Sox. Because I believe science might offer an answer to the curse of the Bambino. Because I hear you hired Bill James.
Yep. You know, why someone took so long to hire that guy is beyond me.
Well, baseball hates him.
Well, baseball can hate him, you know. One of the great things about money is it buys a lot of things. One of which is the luxury to disregard what baseball likes, doesn't like, what baseball thinks, doesn't think.
Sounds nice. Well, I was grateful for the call.
You were grateful?
Yeah.
For $41 million, you built a playoff team. You lost Damon, Giambi, Isringhausen, Pena, and you won more games without them than you did with them. You won the exact same number of games that the Yankees won, but the Yankees spent $1.4 million per win. And you paid $260,000. I know you're taking it in the teeth out there, but the first guy through the wall, he always gets bloody. Always. This is threatening, not just a way of doing business, but in their minds, it's threatening the game. But really, what it's threatening is their livelihood. It's threatening their jobs. It's threatening the way that they do things. And every time that happens, whether it's a government or a way of doing business or whatever it is, the people who are holding the reins, they have their hands on the switch, they go batshit crazy. I mean, anybody who's not tearing their team down right now and rebuilding it using your model, they're dinosaurs. They'll be sitting on their ass on the sofa in October watching the Boston Red Sox win the World Series.
What's this?
I want you to be my general manager. That's my offer.
First of all, we got to get the character transcendence taken care of. Do you guys know who the John Henry actor was opposite Brad Pitt in this scene? Nobody knows. He was adult Squints in Sandlot. Yep.
Get out of here.
What adult, the guy at the end who like thumbs up, that's yeah. Him, same actor. So he grew up to be the owner of the Red Sox. Like, that's really good for him. He started in Sandlot in the 50s and now he owns the Red Sox. So, yep.
Interesting. There you go.
Actor must like baseball.
So besides the baseball universe connections, yeah, what were you guys' reactions?
I'm probably going to have the briefest response here. You know, I've probably seen this movie two other times from when I watched it a couple weeks ago. I mean, I like it, and I actually listened to half of the book today. Yeah, I like it. You know, I think what I appreciate the film doing and the book doing and the speech obviously getting at the core of the thing is that it humanizes something that can feel unhuman, right? To just look at the numbers game of the sport and figure out how we can optimize it.
Sure.
Especially something as human and culturally significant as baseball, right? The crack of the bat, the peanuts, the cracker jacks, right? There's all these things that make baseball sort of unique. And and just this dynamic of feeling sort of offended throughout the film of those things being potentially taken away if you sort of sterilize it with this thing of Moneyball. But yeah, at the same time, Billy Bean, with his experiences and as a someone who is sort of a victim to the traditional methods in a sense, made it feel more meaningful and familiar, I suppose, because we all suffer in personal unexpected ways. So,
Theus, did you have any initial reactions to the speech? Just the movie in general.
Kind of like in my rambling at the intro, I think that it is kind of like a microcosm of society and sports today, that even though it was a while back, that it still holds true in a lot of aspects.
Yeah, we'll get into more of that for sure later on. But Ross or Landon, what did you guys think of the speech in the movie?
First reaction to just the speech, like just looking at that, like I think first reaction is just like, man, that's pretty impressive, like what he was able to do. I mean, the Yankees spent $1.4 million per win, and you pay $260,000. It's like, oh, so he like clearly found an effective, like a new way to do things that worked pretty darn well.
Yeah, I think this speech transcended sports with some of the drive home message, and it's this speech that takes the even the phrase Moneyball that you'll hear in like business pitches or ways to describe the evolution of markets, economics, like you can even tie it into like AI, like with AI, you know, for much less money, you can use big data, which it is. I mean, AI is just like Moneyball, you know, squared. It's it's, you know, taking averages and just, you know, do a couple million billion iterations of what prediction could be next for whatever it be, this word, this image, etc., and take the best guess at it. That's the same as him throwing up like, we don't have to replace Giambi and Damon, we need to replace an aggregate 800 batting average, and we'll, or 800 on base average, and we'll just find three guys that add up to a little over 800, and that's what we're looking for. Yeah, I think it is interesting that he explicitly says, like, you know, whether it's the government or doing business or however, you know, people have to make the switch and like the growth or the evolution of something more powered by data, statistics, technology is perhaps inevitable. I was just listening to another podcast yesterday about basically the first business stock trading firm that used calculus and the first models of like statistical prediction to just basically they invented quantitative trading to like, here's everything that we know about the markets and the stocks and the percentage up and down and then, you know, the volume, etc. And without knowing who the CEO is or if they sell toilet paper or computers, based on what the charts and the math say, like there's a 70% chance we should buy right now and do thousands of those trades every second. And it was just pure computing power and the use of math that allowed them to do that. And you can see that applied in trading, in baseball. I'll stop there. There's some great basketball examples as well.
Yeah, and I think the word that stuck out in the speech is threatening.
Yeah,
like he uses it a couple times, and I think that it's I think he like really captured what Billy Bean was doing in this sort of novel approach. But maybe to juxtapose things a little bit, I guess what was your guys' growing up experience with sports? We'll kind of maybe start there, kind of talk about what Moneyball did or. And how that changed things, and then, kind of the aftermath of sports. But, like, I think it does kind of extrapolate broadly to some life things, too. But let's hear from our special guest, Theus Brown. What was your growing up experience with sports? What did it do for you? Any particular formative experiences on the sports front?
I think in particular, guys, I think kind of my first time playing organized playing organized sports in general and – almost kind of like a snobbery for the workforce. And, you know, a lot of times you have to, you know, work with people of different backgrounds, different, you know, races, religions, cultures. So you have to get used to, you know, being in a locker room or being in a dugout with people from all different walks of life. And whether you knew the kids growing up or you come from different social statuses, you have to get along and come together for a common goal. So I think a lot of times sports can help you prepare for the business world or for even the, you know, just even family environments as well.
I mean, sports were pretty big for me growing up. I definitely think, I mean, from age probably 12 to 22, maybe 21, they're pretty much just the defining, like, if that's how I would have defined or identified myself, like, any certain group or activity, that was probably the number one thing. Just, you know, played sports pretty much year-round through, you know, late elementary, junior high, high school, and then sort of was still super interested in watching sports and maybe playing some more, like, intramural-type sports in college. So I think that just it was a huge part of my life. I definitely, there was a lot of pluses and, you know, the kind of general things you can learn from sports, work hard, dedication, that type of thing. So something that, and I said, it really still sticks out to me, kind of like a lesson from sports as far as humility goes. I remember my first ever tackle football game. So I'm in fourth grade, and my dad told me on the way to the game, if you are lucky enough to score a touchdown, act like you've been there before. And I mean, I guess it was pretty formative, if, you know, I can still just completely quote it, you know, without really giving it much thought. And I think that just really stuck a lot as far as just how to act with success. And I mean, like, not like one touchdown is this huge success, but just this kind of idea that, you know, you have to not lose. I want to get too far, you know, don't forget who you are type thing, but just more of a, you can't just lose sense of yourself in the moment and what's going on. Just because you know, have a little bit of a success. So I think that definitely always stuck with me. And then the only other, like, the other big thing I can think of, John Wooden, you know, basketball coach for UCLA. I've read a bunch of his books, and those were just very influential on me. So, I mean, like, right now I'm looking at a picture of John Wooden right above my desk, and if you asked me, like, who are the people that influenced you most in your life, to be totally honest, until I was in college, it absolutely would have been my mom, my dad, and John Wooden, just from reading his books. So I feel like they had a big impact on me, spent a lot of time playing them, and definitely shaped kind of how I thought and acted for, yeah, still to this day in a lot of ways.
Yeah, basketball was king in the Schaefer household from second grade until eighth grade or so. And and you know, the standard soccer and baseball sprinkled in there early, but and volleyball, give that honorable mention. But yeah, I mean, the biggest things that stick out to me was just how much fun basketball was. Our team, we were pretty good. And, yeah, so just having that sense of team camaraderie and memories together of competing against some of the better teams in the Belleville Diocese. But then, of course, I sort of found my way in high school taking on the less traditional sports with cross country and track. And those sort of having their own more, one might say, esoteric ethos than your traditional grunting and sweating of your Neanderthal disciplines.
I'm sure there's zero grunting or sweating.
Yeah, no one sweats when they run 14 miles.
No one sweats or grunts, yeah. But yeah, no, I would say, I mean, I think I'll just, I might just share one small anecdote, I think, as a summary. But I mean, I like what Thea said in terms of teaching, you know, preparing you for a lot of things. And a quick little plug. So Thea is the host of the Bejic and Brown show, mostly sports oriented in their content, but he interviews a wide variety of guests as well. But the Janice Collins episode is one I listened to recently that, you know, I think she speaks well to. Yeah, just to her experience of sports and formative, you know, how it forms people. And I think a lot of us have that experience. But I'll give a shout out to my Uncle Larry. I think this is just a formative thing. So 7, 8 year old boy, I was playing a card game at some sort of family get-together at my aunt's lake house. I was losing, and I was getting really whiny about it. And my Uncle Larry just kind of burst into the room, said, "Matthew, you're coming with me." So takes me out to the porch, sits me down. And like when he does that, like my aunts are like, "Matthew, you better go with your Uncle Larry," you know, like, you know, whatever. So it was kind of like a little bit, not a scene, but a little bit of a scene. But takes me out on the porch. He asked me who my favorite Bulls player was. So I'm like, Scottie Pippen. That's who I was, a little contrarian. I didn't want to be with Michael Jordan like everyone else. So Scottie Pippen was my boy. Didn't really matter who I said, because he, you know, but he basically went down, you know, when the Bulls are down, when the Bulls are in trouble, when they're losing, you know, and they're down by 8 points with 5 minutes left to the Utah Jazz, like, do they whine about it? Like, have you ever seen them whine on the court? And you know, they don't do that. They buckle down, they stick with it, and they play tougher, you know, when they're down. So anyway, that was a lesson and it, like a moment that I'll never forget. Yeah, I don't even know if he meant it to be that impactful, but I think it was one of those things, a formative experience that really kind of stuck with me. And yeah, so like a microcosm of the goodness sports. It's a battleground and a proving ground for a lot of young men to kind of grow in that way.
Yeah, I mean, just briefly on that point of like whining, that is something I didn't necessarily think of, that is lost, obviously, when you don't keep score, right, in younger kids' league play. Yeah, you obviously don't learn how to lose well. Yeah. Maybe Donald Trump never played Little League baseball.
Or listen to our quad on speeches by losers.
That's right.
I do need to interject while you're prepping for our next spot. It was Smalls, not Squints. Smalls was the main character.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Yeah,
I knew
that
it.
Makes
I
know more eyes.
No, I feel, I'm so embarrassed. Like, that is just, Squints Kids is Wendy. Smalls is the main character. His adult version is the gentleman who gives the speech in.
I was thinking Smalls when you said Squints, yep. But okay.
Yeah, just a little bit of a misstep.
All right, well, you're off next episode. All right? Don't whine about it either. But so what have you guys noticed has changed with the Moneyball phenomena? I think that's so kind of talked about our coming of age years and some nostalgia. I'm sure we'll get more nostalgia, but what have you guys noticed?
Maybe as an interesting sort of transition to sort of the next set of questions is, do you guys worry as fathers? Mm. Theus, are you a daddy yet? God willing.
Not that I know. I haven't answered those letters in the mail yet, but no.
Don't answer them. Are you concerned that with Moneyball's influence on professional sports, of that contaminating some of the noble memories you have of youth sports growing up?
I'm not sure it's. Oh, go ahead. No. You're up. I just talked.
I think to the point we're kind of seeing it already. I think to direct question, it won't affect my memories as a child because those are still, a different era, I guess. So it's a different era, and I guess we kind of, like you said, nostalgia is a good and bad thing in a lot of ways, and we see it and shape how we shaped our childhood. And I think all the memories I have were good. I didn't see athletes holding out, and of course we. We're maybe not as aware of certain things, but I think we're seeing that in a more negative way now with sports teams, with, younger and younger athletes, choosing to, NIL money, things like that. So I think the impact from personally myself growing up, no, wouldn't affect that in any way, but probably for the kids growing up today, it would have maybe a negative connotation to it.
But I definitely think that a lot of those negative things are seeping in, just this need to win, just how they play, what matters to them. And not to sound too, everything was great back in the day, but I mean, I put it in the notes. It just seems different than sports were when I was growing up. I mean, my 7-year-old's got kids in his elementary school that have personal trainers.
Holy smokes. I mean, crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Like, it's just nuts to me. And just the amount of, I don't want to ramp too much and get on a soapbox, but just the amount of time spent. I mean, Julie, my wife, were talking about this recently, just how much time families spend just going to kid, like, just letting the kids' sporting events dominate the family, which I'm not saying that you shouldn't support your kids or anything. I'm not trying to say that, but, you know, when every waking hour is spent just stressed and busy and rushing because the kids have one after the other sporting event, and winning is important, and a lot of money goes into them even at a young age. It doesn't seem to have some of the more wholesome, I think, qualities that we kind of all referenced earlier.
It's interesting to hear that you've got, you've seen like trainers at seventh grade. I was kind of going to say, I don't know if the full, like there is, all right, trainers in like gaming and practicing and specializing and like going after excellence. I am sure that has definitely creeped in since we've been in there. When I also think of Moneyball, I think of just like money in sports, which is a bit different concept than I think is the primary thing we're talking about here.
That's a good distinction.
And that I don't think is trickled down. It will. That'll probably be the biggest thing to change. I live in Wheaton, Illinois. I went to a Wheaton College game, D3. And it struck me, I had just heard that like the Purdue basketball team with this NIL stuff, every player on Purdue makes $185,000 a year.
What?
Like, yep. That's the way Matt, here's how I heard it. The way Matt Painter has handled NIL is that like each player gets the same amount of money, which assumes that like Purdue's not, you know, it's on a level of whatever, 50 or 100 other teams in D1 who probably are distributing money and are allowed to pay now. So, I mean, football players, I think there are college athletes getting many millions now. And he just decided to make sure it was like an equal distribution. So I bet that's leaked down to D2 a little bit. And so going to a Wheaton College game, I'm like, this is the highest level of amateur basketball that there is now. Like, there is nothing higher than that. It probably won't ever really, you know, maybe some free burgers, the local brewery or something. I don't know. but I think that that is a wild phenomenon. I don't know if you would have rewound the clock 10 years ago and I would have ever said that, like, you know, besides Calipari and Saban, athletes would be paid that sum of money.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the distinction though with the money ball, because it's not just about like money in sports and whatever. It's about the idea of maximizing this sort of undervalued component of a game, and leveraging that against the rest of the league or what have you. And I feel like a lot of the money ball trends sort of in baseball. I mean, there's the shift and subsequent lowering batting averages, emphasis on walks, pitchers going fewer innings, fewer sacrifice bunts, squeeze, but you know, these kind of fun stolen bases, all these fun, more like exciting plays of the game are on the downtrend, and it's basically just homers, walks, getting on the, like the sort of station to station baseball, which isn't as exciting.
I think that question,
Well, I was just going to say a lot of that, I don't know that it translates down to lower levels of sports. So I don't know if you would see it on your local little league team, because kids are stealing bases left and right because catchers aren't that good.
Yeah, true.
You know, at that age, like like you're still going to see a lot of fun stuff at lower levels. But yeah, I mean, I could totally see just the, I guess maybe not like in the minutia, because I mean, there's not, I mean, I can't imagine. Well, maybe there is a world if seven-year-olds are getting personal trainers. You know, maybe there is a world where like coaches, you know, little league coaches are having statisticians, you know, break things down and whatever. But that would just seem totally bizarre to me. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, so would personal trainers.
Yeah, I think.
But I guess things just seem to be moving that way in a way that's a little bit unnerving, and I think just totally changes the experience for the kid, you know. It's like less developing skills and learning skills and competing, like, for sure. I'm not saying, you know, like, I like what Mike said about, you know, yeah, you need to learn not to whine when you lose. But yeah, there's just, it doesn't seem to have trickled down a ton, but, you know, who knows? I don't know.
I think that they tie in together a little bit, though, in the sense that, like, kind of like you said, like, Billy Bean was trying to compete and win games. So he was trying to, you know, find these things that maybe other people didn't value that he could use to have an advantage. But then, you know, certain powers that be view that as a way to make money, right? So then all of a sudden, so it's like, I feel like there's a difference between, like, I want to win and, you know, be creative versus, like, I want to do it as, you know, maximize the value, meaning, like, how much money I'm putting into this person to get sure. a certain, you know, metric or success or whatever. But I feel like, kind of like you said, trickling it down, I feel like I could see it still trickling it down because of just who the kids are watching, too, right? So, like, so sure. I would That's be true. Interested. I don't have any stats to back this up. Three-pointer shot in junior high games, pre and post-Steph Curry. Like, I mean, but,
oh, it's terrible.
But, like, this, right, the statistics, like, people, the NBA doesn't shoot those shots, the middle range anymore. So, like, Steph Curry thrives, changed the game, and I bet that that's what all the kids are doing, even though it probably, you know, half of them probably aren't strong. I mean, you have kids that are too young to be shooting that distance, and they're jacking their shot just to get it there, you know? So I feel like that it does seem to, I don't know, you start to reduce the sport to something about, just to, it does make it, I think at the highest level, it's money and value and you know, getting the sport to win a game and at the cheapest cost or to make the most money. But I do think that probably does trickle down to
sure.
to younger ages, right?
Yeah, what the kids are seeing.
I think, I mean,
yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, to print with a really broad brush, like, I feel like you even see similar things in the, I mean, I don't think it's a sport, but like other avenues of life. So, I mean, hunting is an example. So, you know, I like to deer hunt. But so shooting big bucks is a huge thing now. And not that it wasn't like ever cool, you know, 40 years ago, I'm sure, but the amount of emphasis and stress and focus that's put on shooting the biggest buck measured in a certain way. So there's different scoring systems to if you kill a buck, and you know, how many inches grown is effectively, that's the big goal. But I mean, if you pick up a hunting magazine today, that's all it talks about, is trying to shoot the biggest buck, and that's the only goal.
Sure.
And you know, most, I feel like people would say things kind of like we kind of nostalgically talked about sports, you know, hunting allows me to spend time with my son, to be outdoors in the woods, provide food for my family, but it's kind of become just, how do I shoot the biggest deer?
Well, I think another succinct way to put what you're saying, you know, you're sort of contemplating the reality is that ideas have consequences, right?
Sure.
And, you know, I did type in at one point prepping for this, like, what happened to Moneyball? A very intelligent question. And one of the articles that came up with something is like, Oakland is tired of Moneyball, right? And then without clicking on the article, you can just let that sort of flavor linger. But I mean, I am aware of the note that someone made here. I'll just read it out loud for clarity. Baseball recently changed rules to encourage faster games, stealing bases, largely due to a diminishing fan base who is increasingly preferring faster paced games and stealing bases. Yeah, and what Ross was saying with the hunting, I think, is insightful too. You know, it's like you have this effort by Billy Bean, obviously, that's communicating this really compelling, interesting way. Like, hey, guys, look, we're just trying to pay for runs. When I point at you, talk, right? It's like Brad Pitt does it. It's like, yeah, yeah. But then as we're seeing here, it's like, people are illustrating by not attending baseball games, right? That, hey, this is actually not what we want. And as I'm sort of like contemplating a certain like metaphor for that reality, that observation, a couple things come to mind. You know, Ross had mentioned the 15-foot jump shot, the stealing bases, and it's like, how many kids growing up who are adults now can look back and think, they don't talk about necessarily like, oh, the Chicago Bulls won 72 games and this is how they optimized it in 1996. No, they talk about the base Jackie Robinson stole in whatever World Series, or the 15-foot jump shot on Byron Russell in June of 1998.
Is jockstrap like, still on the floor? Still on the floor.
I bet it is. I bet it is. He's still wiping the floor with it, right? Like, and of course, like, wins matters. Like, there's a certain number of regimentation and that was necessary there to make those things happen. But at the end of the day, people still want heart in their sports. I'll give one more illustration from the distance running world that I'm, you know, more familiar with in a lot of ways, right? There's this guy, Steve Prefontaine. And recently I was talking with my buddy Charlie Hatch, who's a 403 miler himself, went to Cornell. And he remarks, you know, I'll actually put it with you guys. Who's the fastest 5,000 meter runner in the United States?
Is it you?
Right now?
Right now.
It was something Kingston or Kingsbury? Isn't there a kid like... He's like 18 or something, right?
Impressive you know that much. I don't know. It's possible, I don't know who he is.
Yeah, I don't know. But
I don't know who he is. You're supposed to just say, I don't know. What's a 5,000 meter?
Oh, 5,000? Oh, I was thinking the like 1970s. Sorry. It's the same distance.
In the 1970s, it was Steve Prefontaine. And Steve Prefontaine has this quote. A lot of people run a race to see who's the fastest. I run a race to see who has the most guts. Mm. And the point is that Steve Prefontaine, he saw a race as a work of art, right? And every sport in its own way is this work of art. Steve Prefontaine was this icon in many ways of, you know, not chasing after the perfect split in the race, but running from the heart, right? And people came and paid to see that and were inspired to become runners themselves. So, again, just sort of restating what I'm saying here, is Moneyball, you know, as indicated by the things we just mentioned, is sort of, it seems, potentially pulling the rug out from underneath itself in this pure monetization of runs.
Sure. But what maybe I think a pivot, a little bit of a pivot here. What might an optimal version of sports look like?
England soccer.
You know, like what? All right. Tell me more.
So England soccer has, it's so complicated. I don't even know. But there's all kinds of leagues. Obviously, I think the Premier League is at the top, but then there's relegation and et cetera. The comparison, I think, is A, they don't have college sports, and we'll just say college soccer. That's their basketball, football, right? So they don't have, like, a robust amateur, fake air quotes, because it's not amateur anymore, system. And literally every town that, you know, has a spitting 50,000, 100,000 people, 25,000, has a soccer team. And technically, with a little bit of wins, perhaps some talent, like you have a shot, theoretically, to, like, have a couple good years and, like, be, you know, the example would be, like, a Peoria or Decatur Springfield team, you know, playing against LeBron for a season. And I think that allows for, I don't know exactly how you play pro soccer in a small town.
Or even Council Bluffs. I don't know. Council Bluffs might not make it.
And I think the merger or the tearing down of a little bit of the formalities between NCAA and professional, and widening that out has all kinds of interesting things at the pro level. So I'd throw that out there.
Theus, any thoughts on your end about just optimizing things? I mean, I don't want to bash Council Bluffs. I had the best haircut I'd ever had from Council Bluffs. I forget the name of the barber, but yeah, there's a good barber.
Are you guys talking about Council Bluffs, Iowa, but, like the one near Omaha?
Yeah, by Omaha. Yeah, cool. Have you been there?
I've driven through.
All right, that's Theus's. Those are Theus's stomping grounds.
Oh, that's beautiful country out there, nice and wide open.
So, Theus, any thoughts about just like what does optimal sports look like? How might whether it's just for an adult, for society, for your family, like, you know, what does that look like?
I hate to sound like a repetitive get off my lawn guy, but I think it's just continue to teach, and like we mentioned earlier, the good memories that we had of the past, continue to teach those characteristics. It's not about what happens, but you know, like you said, you guys are fathers to your sons, to your daughters. Continue to teach those good values and those good morals, and eventually, maybe their whole, all their teammates or everyone they compete with will not do it, but as long as you can reach some generation to teach, you know, good sportsmanship, like the gentleman said about his dad, said, act like you've been there before. If you score a touchdown, there's no need to score. But that's why I have a problem with NFL, and I know everybody loves football as king, but I have a hard time watching guys, you know, celebrate and do the moonwalk when they're down by four touchdowns. You know what I mean? So I guess in the long term, I'm trying to sum it up to say the characteristics, the values, just the principles of good sportsmanship and continuing to create that, you know, culture within each locker room or each playing field. But it starts with the parents. Again, teaching young kids, instead of watching us at AAU tournaments acting like idiots, and we talk about the athletes being overpaid and stupid. We're acting like this, and we're not getting paid. So God forbid if our kids get arrested and do something, how will we respond to that, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, it kind of unstated, but I think very, like, vital to what you're saying is just, like, kind of you're talking about the community, you know what I mean? You're talking at, like, families. You're talking about coaching, the grade school team or the local park district team. I feel like coaching might be the, at least for an adult who's kind of past their prime, like I imagine all of us are, you know, like coaching's kind of, that's, I feel like that's our niche. Easy there, Mike. Not all of us can do one arm hangs. All right. I'm sorry. I wish I could, but we'll see if you win the next, weightlifting contest in the Schultz garage, Mike. But I feel like coaching's probably number one, you know, and like Theus was getting at, because that's where you really teach values to kids, and that's where you really kind of hand on these sorts of traditions and things that, you know, whether you're mathematically thinking about stealing bases or not, or, you know, just different strategy. Like, everyone's always trying to get a good strategy, you know, like there's nothing nothing against that. And I feel like that's where Moneyball shines. It is a novel approach to that sort of thing. But I obviously it can be reductive, you know, and that's where if you reduce everything to these sorts of mathematical equations, you miss out on a lot of teaching opportunities, especially for kids. But I feel like locality is maybe the biggest thing. And I know for a stretch, I was terrible at following it, but I at least had a goal or a vision to, for every time I look at the NBA standings or like a professional sport or, you know, even college sports, like before I do that, check the local high school teams. You know what I mean? Just in terms of my personal sports media consumption, because I feel like that's a good way to moderate. And like, all right, I'm involved in my community now. I understand like what different schools are doing, what different kids are doing, and just at least has me a little bit more invested locally, because that would be an area where I potentially could make an impact, you know, coaching for, you know, even if it's like fourth grade girls basketball at St. Phil's, like, all right, they need a coach, like, great, you know, that could be a way where you start teaching kids how to play, but also, yeah, just other things about how sports can impact you in a more purely positive light as opposed to just the strategic, mathematical, reductive light.
Like, I feel like you have to separate a little bit. Are you trying to play or are you trying to produce? So, like, I'm always struck with... Yeah. Because I was always, I still am, but I was very competitive, you know, so I wanted to be good and succeed and blah, blah, blah. But, like, kids, like, little kids, they just want to play. So, like, I'm always struck with my son or the kids who, like, even if they're not going to be very good, like, they want to turn. So, even if they can't hurt with a lick, like, yeah. They want to go bat. Because they don't really care what happens, like, they want to turn to play, if that makes sense. And I think that...
Sure.
Where, like, if you go to the complete opposite end, I mean, that's their, like, a professional athlete, that's their job. You know, they're making money, they're trying to, they have enough money, but, like, you know, that's their income to support their family, if you will. So they're trying to produce, you know?
Sure.
So there's a lot different pressure and goal for what they're trying to do. And I feel like there's just a big temptation, not even, like, for my kid, for myself, I think, to produce at a younger and younger age right now. And, so I think kind of keeping that mindset, you know, what am I here to do? What am I trying to do? So yeah, if the four of us go, you know, and I feel like the better you are at something, I guess there can be kind of a flirting line between. So I'm thinking, you know, if the four of us went on a run, Mike's probably going to care about his time a little bit more than I would. Or if, you know, the four of us go golfing, Landon's going to care a little bit more about the score because you guys are better at it, those things. But I feel like just kind of having that mindset of what's my goal, what am I trying to do, and just having the appropriate one for whatever setting you're in is probably just a healthier way to embrace sports. And I think too often, you know, if somebody doesn't want to go bat when they're 8 years old because they're afraid of striking out, you probably have something wrong or, you know, they've learned something not the best way.
Every collegiate and professional sports team needs a director of heart. And every athlete's output is in the number of Rudy Rudigers they give each practice. That's the units.
That's the metric.
Did you just create a new unit of measurement?
Rudy.
the Rudiger measurement.
Have I ever told you guys that my high school wrestling coach is Rudy Rudiger's brother?
Brother? That's
what? He's the yeah. So the Rudiger family, like a bunch of the boys are wrestling coaches, and they had the Rudiger Cup. So one of them at the time they coached at Manuka. My high school coach has retired since, so he doesn't coach anymore. But he coached at Neuqua Valley. I forget where the other one did, but they had there were four of them, I think, and they had a quad, so that, you know, like a little mini tournament, and they would have the Rudiger Cup, which is literally a tin can nailed to like two or three 2x4s. And it was in our wrestling room, and that was, like, the most prized trophy in our, like, wrestling room, mostly because we were always, like, top 10 in state, but we never made it to state because we were always paired up against Glenbard North or Providence or some other better wrestling school. But
so what did he say about his brother? He had to have said something interesting.
He didn't talk about it at all. He was very private about it. There were some
– You saw the movie? His brothers hated him.
Podcast just for so the family didn't really appreciate that presentation of themselves in the movie, I'm sure.
And so they manifested it.
He was very private about his thoughts on the movie, but there were some rumblings I'll share with you off scenes. Maybe our platinum subscribers can hear some of that content, but
well,
I'll leave it there.
I'll cut it out. Just, can you tell us out of curiosity right now?
Anyway, that's the story behind that.
Yeah, without that tension, it's not a very interesting story.
Sure. Yeah, and I get why they did it for the movie. Yeah, but anyhow, Rudy Rudiger's, I do think, is a valid measurement. I'll start doing some statistical analysis on the effect of Rudy Rudiger's on performance.
Turns out you lose a lot more games. You actually want LeBron James's, not Rudy. You don't want 5-6 people on D1 football teams.
Then, what about the LeBron to Rudy ratio? That's an important one, too.
He's more LeBrons.
All right. Maybe, all right. Do we want to switch to the final bell question? And Theus, the final bell is just one final round robin. We try to keep our answers relatively brief, but it's kind of the final thing. I don't know if we want to go there yet or if there's other things we want to talk about. But
here, we don't have to do this, but I did read the entirety of the most nihilistic one, of course.
Oh, I thought you might.
Why I gave up sports, why you should
consider. I read that too.
How to start.
Yep, I did.
Did you guys read? Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think the main question, well, I guess a couple questions, like, does sports take up too much of the cultural mindset? And, like, maybe what does sports consumption look like? We've talked about a little bit about participation, but, you know, obviously that being ideal. But, yeah, maybe what does sports consumption look like on a ideal level? But, yeah, so what are your thoughts on that article, Mike?
You know, yeah, so, I mean, I guess it's getting at how sports influences us as a source of social influence, right? The gentleman who wrote this article, David S. Heinemann, most significantly in the Medium online platform. What most bothered him was it basically how these players or coaches at the professional or collegiate level getting off scot-free after some substantial infringement. Let me see if I can find any worthwhile quote in here of either myself or him. I'll just read what I wrote. Two cultural satellites came up for me with the commentary on the seemingly indestructible social power of those in charge in sports. Untouchability despite pretty clear crimes committed, and the faithful masses ensuring that power by apologizing for them. Yeah, and thinking of satellites as GOP especially, Democrats to some extent, any Christian or just institutional in general, sexual abuse scandal over the last several decades. Yeah, just the idea of, like, the common people, the masses, basically apologizing for those who are in the thing.
Sure.
If that makes sense. In this case, the athletes and the coaches, and that enabling them.
Sure.
Yeah, I guess did that stick out to you guys, like the significance of that problem?
The whole problem of sports being too much, or that specific example on abuse?
Either one.
I think scanning through that article, it was basically, yeah, he was very deep into sports, tons of fantasy leagues, his whole weekend's consumed. and then at the end he lists like steps to like kind of just untether yourselves, and I think I resonated with that perhaps in my 20s. I used to, like, the cable subscription would come up and be like, well, I've got to, like, renew because I need to always be able to, like, watch the Masters and Illini basketball games. And sports what always did, like, you know, that's basically why I kept TV. But then, whatever, several years ago, I'm like, if I need to see it, I'll figure out a way, or I'd only really probably watch it like at a friend's house or whatnot. And I've just, like, as the years have gone by, I pretty much like watch the Masters and 3 or 4 Illini ball games that are like scheduled programming. If it's easy to, I don't really ever, friend had it on or it was on somewhere, I'd watch it, but like as far as like scheduled programming, it's like, yeah, oh, this game is on at this time and I'm gonna sit down. Yeah, Masters and NCAA Illini basketball essentially. And yeah, I don't think it was overly intentional, other than it used to be a bigger part of my ethos, identity, agenda, something that I had to like build into my life, and now I really don't try that much anymore. And it, the benefits he talked about, like he has all these other hobbies that he works on himself more. And I would resonate with that a little bit. Like I playing it or doing it or participating in something is something I value more than consuming it.
I read the article and I think there's something, I mean, to like your last point, like playing it versus consuming it. Like, yeah, I think there's something to be said for maybe, you know, it'd be better to go play, pick up basketball with my friends than watch a bunch of basketball or, you know, yada, yada, yada. But I don't know, at least for me, the article, it kind of sounded like somebody that was just in it really extreme. So I needed like a really extreme solution. So almost like an alcoholic can't touch alcohol. Yeah, like. You know what I mean? Like somebody that's been addicted to alcohol, it's like they won't touch it. Where it's like, for, you know, a lot of people, it's like, yeah, I can have a couple drinks and, you know, have fun a little bit or whatever, but like not go overboard. And like, so, yeah, there does seem to be more of a happy medium than maybe presented, I thought, in the article. That was kind of my first take on that one.
Yeah, and that's where, because I think there is something helpful. And I mean, or just thinking about my upbringing, like I watched a lot of like looking back, I would say too much, like too much baseball, too much sports.
How much do you watch right now?
But curious, at the same
like,
time,
what are you guys?
I mean, in the summer, hardly any. I might listen to a game on the radio while I'm like doing dishes or while I'm, you know, putzing in the yard or something. In the summertime, hardly any at all. Football season, I might watch a Bears game every third week. It's kind of, I probably watched, of the 17 games, I probably watched six.
Ross, what do you, like, programmatically schedule? Then we'll come, we'll finish up, Matt.
Yeah, I watch, for college football, I watch college game day on Saturday mornings. And then, I would say most Illini, 60% of Illini football games.
Football, not basketball?
I watch most Illini basketball games, or at least I should say part of them, though I will say out of just, not even guilt, just honesty, I don't let myself watch, like, turn on the game and watch it, because I just, again, total honesty, like, I can't not get sucked in. So maybe, and Illini basketball, maybe I am more the addict. So, like, if the game's from 5 to 7, I won't turn it on. Because I know that I'll be very inattentive to my kids. If the game's from 8 to 10, I'll watch the second half after the kids go to bed. So, either there. So, Illini basketball, I watch part of a lot of games.
And then Mike.
And that's about it, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, I follow Cardinals baseball, but because of just the length of baseball games, I don't watch a lot
of them. So, you don't watch any golf? That's why you're not dropping your score, man.
Hey, I've been chipping a lot in the basement. It's coming down.
And Mike, he watches watches 4 minutes of the mile every 4 years in the Olympics, and that's it.
Mike's actually confused what we're talking about tonight.
Up on sports since Jordan retired the second time. So.
When we've been talking about football, Mike is literally picturing people playing soccer.
Yeah, well, and that's something I appreciate about the. Plugging the Bejek and Brown podcast. So if you look up Bejek and Brown, Theo 3ND, you can plug a little bit more at the end, Theus, if you want. But yeah, you guys kind of plug the local teams. I know you interviewed a Neuqua Valley player, a alumni at my high school who's, I think, playing at Northern Illinois at one point back in the day. But what's that? Yeah. All right, you're good. But that's right, Neuqua Valley, go Wildcats. Your family like necessitates that. You know what I mean? Like there's certain things you just can't get around once you're married, once you have kids, and I think that is a good moderating force. But I think at least when I was growing up, like there is like a certain ethos around sports about, you know, I know Ross mentioned just hard work, you know, discipline, you know, how to act. And it was like an avenue for my dad to kind of just teach me about certain things. Like if there was an athlete who showboated or if there is an athlete who just talked about themselves too much, you know, or there's something really good that happened, like teamwork, you know, like, hey, you see that? See what that player did? Like he could have had a shot, but he passed, made that extra pass. Now they had an easy layup, you know. I feel like there are things that you can learn just by watching, you know, and that's something I don't want to completely neglect or completely avoid. And I think just sports culture, generally speaking, I think oftentimes is healthy in terms of just some of those life lessons, some of those, important themes, I guess. That like if had I not experienced that, you know, had I not watched the Bulls as a kid, you know, had my dad not watched the Bulls as a kid, I wouldn't have been able to, you know, my Uncle Larry, that Uncle Larry conversation that was so formative, you know, wouldn't have resonated the same because I wouldn't have had a favorite player. You know, I would have just been an 8-year-old kid playing with trucks or dinosaurs or whatever I was playing with, you know. But it's like I had a favorite player. I had someone who meant something to me. And that was like, yeah, he doesn't whine. Yeah, like that's, I feel like there is something to that. I guess some positive aspect of sports consumption. And yeah, of course we need to moderate it. And it sounds like the as a whole, this group of guys is doing that. But yeah, I think there's, it's just an interesting balance. You know, like you mentioned, Ross, with the guy who, you know, it sounds like, yeah, if you have a problem, which I might have had a problem at some point in college, you know, just thinking back about how much sports consumption I participated in. I feel like I've kind of hit a groove a little bit where, you know, you watch the important things and, but you value something else. And I think that's the main point is like if our culture just isn't valuing things outside of sports, outside of money, outside of that stuff, like that's where sports get skewed. You know what I mean?
So I'm just trying to think. So say, because I feel like we've kind of talked about both, on the positive influence of sports, but also, you know, maybe some negative effects. Not necessarily only because of Moneyball, but maybe Moneyball was used in some maybe not so great ways. But if I'm picturing like a nostalgic moment, you take Abe up to, you know, watch a Sox game. You know, you guys get there early, maybe get some players' autographs on some baseballs. You can tell them about that game you went to and the home run and the seats and stories about your dad and, you know, maybe listen to games on the radio and Peanuts are falling, Cracker Jacks, the works. But then Abe's like, what if he's like, Dad, why do you care if they win? What would you tell him? Because, like, you do care, but, like, what do you tell him?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, I think there is...
Because winners win! Winners win, son!
No, so, I mean, you're kind of reminding me of the Jerry Seinfeld bit I posted. I don't know if you guys watched that one. But about, you know, if you're rooting for the team or, you know, the players, but the players get traded and leave. And you know, you're not rooting for the owners. And most people don't know who the owners are. You know, what do you... You know, you're rooting for laundry, you know, is kind of his thing. But... I mean, I think one, there's loyalty, and I think that's an important thing that, especially as a kid, the Bears stunk. The White Sox were very mediocre. They won the World Series in 2005. I was a sophomore in high school at that time, but most of my younger years, I was rooting for teams that weren't good. You know, the Bulls were an anomaly. You know, like really young, great. I had my taste of victory, you know, with the Bulls run, but... I think there's like a loyalty thing. I think there's, I mean, for me, like my dad grew up on the South Side of Chicago. We lived close enough to Chicago. Like I felt like the White Sox represented the city I was from, like the area I was from, and certainly the area my dad was from. He grew up on the South Side. So like, I feel like there's an element of, like, this is your family's team. This is your region, you know, this is your city's team. And these are the people you support no matter what, you know, and there's a loyalty element there. So I guess like loyalty and then just like your heritage, I guess, might be the two biggest things is like, why do I care if the White Sox win or lose? Because they're my dad's team. They're the team that I grew up nearest. And, yeah, I mean, he'll grow up in Peoria, so maybe, yeah, I don't know, White Sox, Cardinals, I don't know. Like, I guess there's kind of halfway between the two cities, but I feel like there's an element of, yeah, just loyalty, heritage, things like that.
The next scene after this speech scene was Jonah Hill pulling Brad Pitt into the room. He's sulky. He's got the largest offer in GM. Didn't win the championship. He's still so sulking over that. And Jonah's like, come watch this tape with me. Shows a video of a guy, kind of a, perhaps, I don't know, it didn't seem like the most athletic MLB prospect guy on a minor league team. Hit a home run. Told a bit of a story about how can you not be romantic about baseball. So, you know, that story, which seemed a little bit more of the emphasis of the film, contrasted with Billy being only caring about winning the championship. Like,
sure.
Which one weighs out? Will they mark whether you won or lost or how you played the game? Grantland Rice, 1928.
Grantland Rice. I have one of his books on my shelf.
For when the one great scorer comes and marks against your name, they'll write not whether you won or lost, but how you played the game. I don't know if it was 1928, but ish.
2008.
The tumult and the shouting I got from my Aunt Duffy after she passed away.
Ross, what would you say?
If you need a minute to think.
Give me a minute.
This also, Mike, before we got on you, your question, can you reframe the question that you asked? When it was like, you really want a nice setup here, I think. But what was the contrast between Jackie Robinson and something?
Why do I need to re-record what? This?
Did we record it already? Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think we did.
All right, sorry.
That was the Michael Jordan.
The crowd was on its feet.
Hey, Luke, don't fix it. Do it again.
Dad, cut all this. Mike.
Yeah, I could try it a different way. Hey, let me try this. Hold on.
I don't want to add to your...
Maybe I should do more pauses. There's this guy, Jackie Robinson. Okay, right. Ross, why your kid asks you, why do we care about our home team winning? What do you say after you get off your phone?
I think it would be good, just trying to think out loud here. So, like, it's okay to have a goal. And, right, in a lot of ways, the most superficial goal of a sporting event is to win the game. So it's fine to have this goal in mind, that we want to win the game. Celebrate, clap hands, you know, we achieved the goal. But I think that, so it's okay to want your team to win. Because in some ways, I feel like you kind of feel like you're part of your team, right? Not that what I do has any influence on Illini basketball or Cardinals baseball, but kind of for all the reasons Matt stated earlier, like that's your, maybe your dad's team, maybe where you went to school, maybe the town you're from, the team you grew up watching. For whatever reason, you feel like you're part of the team, which I think is kind of why sports are fun, like professionally. The sports you can't play. So I think it's totally fine to want your team to win and to cheer for them to win. But I think it's more just the mindset you have. Like, so that's this goal that we have. But I feel like you have to not keep in mind, but have a sense of those. I feel like those other things we talked about are the bigger things. Those are why sports are more endearing and why they actually matter. Is because of those experiences and opportunities they provide, whether it's playing a game and the lessons learned or the nostalgic moments, you know, going to a game with your dad. So I feel like I'm trying to think of, you know, we went to a lot of Cardinal, I mean, not a lot. We went to a fair amount of Cardinal games growing up and, right, like I can't tell you if they won or lost any of the games we went to, but all, you know, you'll talk about all the fun and experiences and times you had with your my dad, my brother. So I feel like it's fine. I would tell him, I think it's fine to cheer for your team to win, but just having a sense of that's not actually what matters today, though. And yeah, so I think that's how what I would tell him. I hope that, I feel like in some ways kids might be better at that than adults, to actually live out that sense of what actually matters in the moment or at the game. But that's kind of what I was trying to, I feel like I'm trying to try to articulate that in the outline a little bit, kind of this, you know, the middle ground of, we don't have to completely be, you know, old geezers that talk about how much better sports were back in the day, but we also don't have to just tear down sports for, oh, all they care about is stats and money and all that. Like, I think sometimes the answer, you know, at a local level is just going out and playing pickup games or coaching your kids or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And at a professional level is, you know, taking your kids to the game and buying some peanuts and have a really good time with them, and don't let, you know, help him give him that sense of why it's supposed to be fun.
Are you saying that was the final bell, or we're going
to
start?
No, we'll have to come up. We'll have to come up with something.
All right. Should we do the hot takes on the future of American sports? Bold claims.
Oh, yeah, that's fun.
I feel like that would be a, yeah.
I'm getting kind of self-conscious with my Rocky thing. I'm not going to do it.
What are you self-conscious of? That'd be the only thing I'd imagine. It's fun.
All right. It's my performance. I'm more about, you know what? Yeah. I'm thinking performance, not play. I'm going for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Play, man.
Final bell.
Ding, 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 ding.
All your strength. All your power. All your love.
Where are you? 15. One more round. There's no stopping us now. This is our round. Don't stop it now. We're starting, we don't stop. All your strength, all your power, all your love, everything you've got. This is your whole life. Do it now.
And we're back. Not quite a grand slam. We're rounding the bases. We're coming through third. Matt is going to start bringing us home. What do we got, Matt?
We're going to try to beat the throw. We're going to open it up. Any bold claims for the future of American sports? What do you guys got?
Based upon the influence of Moneyball, presumably.
Yeah, based upon Moneyball. Okay. Just, yeah, the direction the okay. world is heading. Yeah, any bold claims for the future of American sports?
Okay. Bold claim. Soccer will displace football as the number one sport.
Whoa. When?
Oh, what, that's interesting.
What time frame are you thinking, Ross?
2000.
That is crazy to hear out of your mouth. I could back up some supporting research I've read about that, but why are you so, why would you say that?
I think, I mean, just made a claim. I mean, first thought was...
Talking out of your ass, just like we like it. No money ball or research.
I mean, first thought, talking out of my ass, more realistically, it seems like, I know I've heard a lot, like, youth football numbers are down.
Are they?
So it seems like there's going to be, like, a, yeah. Like, I think of the concussions and stuff like that. And, I mean, baseball has not been, has been losing popularity and stuff for a long time, I think. And then, so I feel like combined with immigration and stuff like that, it seems like soccer is more popular now than it was when I was a kid. Funny story. I didn't know we had a soccer team. It's totally true. We co-opted with another school and none of us knew until I was a junior in high school. One of the kids in our class went to play on the soccer team. We had no idea we could do that. No one knew. But yeah, so I feel like all those things together, and mainly the youth numbers being down, I think, and I feel kind of my own little circle of people. I know a lot of people that are I know of several moms and such that are concerned about concussions and things like that. So I feel like all of that is like, yeah, I could see soccer getting more popular.
The
St. Louis has a team now.
The there's a couple chapters in a book. I don't think, but Malcolm Gladwell predicted that as well. That the mostly after whatever.
Malcolm Gladwell. What era is that? Is that like 50 years ago? I don't know. I guess
Malcolm Gladwell is a modern writer. He's still kicking out books. Outliers, Blink, David versus Goliath. But his, it kind of like taking on whatever that research the Will Smith movie was on, and like, yeah, perhaps mother's sentiment in American suburbia, was just that it'll kind of like go the way of like boxing, fighting, like it'll be a little like fighting is still a universal, fighting's a little different, but it'll kind of be pay-per-view. It'll be a bit too violent, perhaps. Like, it's not going to have, like, the major market share. Fast forward, like, 10, 20 years. And I think some of that's waned a little bit. I kind of thought that was more of a three-year-ago take. But, yeah, hearing Ross organically pile into that and like just quote junior league numbers, it could still probably be out there as like diminishing sport.
Mike, it looks like you got a hot take. You're leaning in. I'm ready for it.
The mile is removed from the Olympic track and field as being an artifact of colonialism and racist.
Am I reading the Babylon Bee right now?
Fair enough. For real sports, Mike.
I can't. Oh, you know, actually, semi-similar note. Man, I don't know how to put this in a more specific, hot way. But, you know, my buddy, who is the cross-country and track coach at Virginia Tech, you know, obviously with Purdue's football team each making $200,000, you know, all that money is not going to what's called the Olympic sports. That, you know, so that's what it sounds like. Sports that are played at the Olympics, essentially, but not your mainstream sort of sports. That how would I put it? They're not going to exist. People are still going to do them, but man, how would they look? Obviously, the competitive level would have to diminish, right? Because Stanford is no longer, or Oregon, they're no longer going to be able to attract great runners because they're not going to have scholarships to give them. So you're just going to have a bunch of dweebs who have nothing else to do joining the cross-country team at Stanford. So that's my hot take. Dweebs doing cross-country at Stanford. That's what I got. I know, not much for me this round.
So real quick, we appear to have lost our special guest, Theus Brown. So, yeah. I'm sure he would have had some great intakes on that, or takes on that. But one final plug for the Bejek and Brown podcast. This is our first ever crossover podcast with another show. So anyhow, but I would say there's a couple things on my end. One, well, actually, Ross, to support yours, but to support yours real quick. So the Premier League, the English Premier League soccer, generated more TV revenue in the United States than Major League Baseball did. I think in 2022 or 23, I can't remember what year. But recently, the English Premier League has surpassed Major League Baseball. So, yeah, more points in Ross's court for that.
They stop stealing but bases.
Oh, yeah, that's what happens.
Boring.
But a couple hot takes. One, I think basketball will go to a no three-point line. I think the three-point line has so totally changed the game that I think it's – I mean, the NBA has become very boring to watch just, you know, you basically in terms of you go down the court, you either shoot a three or you dunk it. And I think, Landon, your graphic, I think it tells a lot of stories, too, that you posted on the outline. Just the shot chart difference between, you know, the 90s, 2000s to today. But
yeah, I hadn't.
I think the NBA is straggling, and they experimented with that in-season tournament thing this year, which was just kind of a random. You know, I think that they're kind of scraping for interest in the middle of the year. People watch at the finals. People watch maybe the first couple of weeks, but yeah, I think that and Greg Popovich had an interview at one point where he said a similar thing. He's a head coach for the San Antonio Spurs. I can't remember if he retired or not, but
I think he's still coaching.
Anyhow, is he still coaching?
Yeah, I hadn't. Have you heard that they might get rid of it, or that's your super hot take?
That's my super hot take. Yeah, I've heard zero inkling that it would actually do it, but I feel like it's going to get to the point where you're just going to have 5'10" guys who are crazy athletic and shoot threes, and it's going to be boring.
I think to watch. I remember when I quoted it in there, but like the Warriors owners were all like tech billionaires and SF, and they just like invested in the one stat. It might not be a little off, but like. Points per attempt for threes were 1.79, and points per attempt for twos were like 1.69. Like a, you know, point one difference in like every time you hucked the ball. And that was enough for them to be like, there should be a team to go all out. Like, just do it. And they did it. They won a ton, and now everybody does it. And I think that it's a little bit like just a rule of the game that has been completely exploited and might have a, you know, it is not the purpose of the game, but to remove it would to take back the whole variety of basketball. I think you can, the longer I've been in like business, just like different entrepreneurs, more of the old school real estate services business, like that is true of many other parts of life, to know of like an ambiguity, a loophole, has anybody pushed the margin on like this law or rule, like that is a bit Moneyball. Like the more you study it and the more you understand where like value hasn't been exploited, perhaps pushes the margins. And I think, you know, unless some other person like figures out how to, you know, make the three irrelevant with another strategy, like basketball as the rules are written now is a bit broken.
Well, so Landon, was that your answer to the question, or is it? Do you have a separate?
I've supported other takes. I don't know what's going to happen in golf. You know, Saudi Arabia is going to own it. I think maybe what is that, a reverse? Ooh, little hot. I'm trying to think. You know, kind of the Islamic caliphate's taking over. Western culture, maybe, is what we got going on there. I'm really kind of hoping that the Big Ten and SEC completely obliterate the NCAA. So I'm pro like mega conference, make the overriding body of college sports completely irrelevant at this point because they haven't controlled amateur sport, and they may or may not have done something to a particular school and their mascot. So but really pro Big Ten SEC to dominate amateur athletics.
There you have it.
Well, Theus, unfortunately you have to miss the final bell, but we made it all home. Grand slam in the truest sense of the word here. So as usual, thanks for drinking.
And thinking.
With us. Be safe out there.
Be safe out there. Thank you. Cue the music.
come and go. Look toward the horizon. Up ahead you'll find a peace of mind, relief from the trying. I have burned a bridge, wrecked in a ditch, had to ask forgiveness. Dead ends come and go. Look toward the horizon. Oh, there are stories to tell. The times we grew and the times we fell. Oh, I've been afraid some days, but the road will lead us to a better place. The road will lead us to a better place.
It's Thursday.
This is Thursday.
I am that recording. Means,
no, it's a third Thursday.
Still Thursday.
It's the speech guy's time.
Welcome.
Oh, yeah.
So, boys, we're coming off a couple weeks later after a heck of a camping trip. All four of us present, which doesn't always happen these days with all of our different responsibilities. Ross, it might be fun for you to sort of lead off. What went down? No. Backtrack. Where were we?
So we are at Chanahan State Park. After we had
Illinois' smallest 21 acres.
After a nice tour of Wheaton, some war museum stuff, Landon's house, the building that has a desk that C.S. Lewis wrote at.
But the desk was tossed out in the next to a garbage can.
The desk and the wardrobe.
Yeah, so we're at Chanahan State Park. It was a nice evening, like usual. Let's see, we had garlic bread, old fashions, chili. It was pretty nice, actually. Chili outside, not too bad.
Ross did the garlic bread in the Dutch oven. I did the chili, and Matt and Landon were just there.
Just there, as usual.
Matt brought vegetables.
I always do lunch, guys.
That's true. Landon buys. I normally feel Landon, bad about lunch, but not this
I keep thinking about that Chick-fil-A platter. That was a beautiful platter. The cold Coors Lights to welcome us. And then my one arm bent arm hang downstairs. It was a perfect morning.
Mm-hmm. So, well, let's just get the elephant in the room out here. So we were sitting around the fire. It was around 10 p.m., I believe. Just to set the scene so I feel better about it later. Multiple cars had come in kind of suspiciously. Shined their lights on us. Kind of kept on going. And then a minivan pulls in about 10 p.m. Three adults get out of it. I thought that was weird, but then I realized that there was four of us in a minivan, so it's not as bad. yeah, and we had Ron and John and a third person come into the campsite, and just to set the scene, I think we were all, like, jokingly scared about it when they first showed up, because one of them just had a large garbage bag that I think someone made a comment could fit a human in. and, yeah, they pitched camp right next to us, despite the fact that they had many other options.
So these guys are squirming in their panties, and they're talking about whether we should just go back home to Landon's, 45 minutes the opposite direction. And I'm going to have none of that, because by the time we're done talking about it, it's pushing 10:30, 11. Well, I'm about the only man and a half in the group, so I pull my North Face hat down tight, put a fresh can of Coors Light in my left hand, and stomp on over to these noobs, and say, hey, what's going on? You guys camp here a lot? You know, just basic sort of talk. And, yeah, they are a little out there, if you will. Anyway, long story short, these kids were just a bunch of goofballs who are partly employed and all these sorts of things. And help them with their fire. Their tent was a disaster, as we saw in the morning. It looked like some people who were under, it's just reality, under the influence, put this up, because there were rods that were in every different direction and plastic poking out where it should not, and practically stumbled out of this mess of a tent when the park ranger came to collect their $6 camping fee. But all in all, it was a great time. Certainly not one to be forgotten by us, nor by Ray and John.
And the third person.
To make it... Yeah, there was a third person. Full disclosure, and... I had voted we go stay at Landon's house, because I was pretty freaked out by these under-the-influence people. Mostly... Well, not mostly. I was generally somewhat concerned they were going to steal our stuff. But... To make Mike less sound less manly. So, because of my concern that they would steal our stuff, I said it. I don't know. You guys seemed open to it. At least locking some of our stuff in the car. Definitely the alcohol. And as we're walking to the car, and at this point it's probably 11:30, we walk by their minivan, and we didn't know that they were in the minivan. was at least somewhat entertaining, but
to add 2 points, because coming to my place was an option, therefore we talked about it. Had we been anywhere else, like, we might not have seemed like a as much of a thing. 2, at the heat of this discussion, after three cars plus a cop car, a massive truck came in with headlights and peeled out figure eights. And so it just felt like something might go down at 2 a.m. that maybe we didn't want to be in the middle of.
Mm-hmm.